And, you know, we're not just another widget company. This is actually a group of very, very deep thinking and oftentimes very aggressive people that have a desire to change the world. That's the kind of journalism that the Washington Post has sponsored and engaged in. In 2023, we published a series of editorials that took a look deep inside how China, Russia, Burma, you know, other places, how these autocracies function. One of the findings was that many of these dictatorships are using technology to clamp down on dissent, even things as tiny as a single tweet. Young people, young college students are being thrown in prison in Cuba, in Belarus, in Vietnam. And I documented these to show how this technology actually isn't becoming a force for freedom, but it's being turned on its head by dictatorship.
We have to leave it there. David Hoffman, Washington Post reporter, stepped down from the Post editorial board when they refused to endorse presidential candidate Mariel Garza, LA Times editorials editor who just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurura, and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the air room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the air room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland area Fred Meyer and QFC workers secure a new three-year contract. Multnomah County is opening 250 recovery beds in the next 2 years, and a new Portland temporary alternative shelter site welcomes RVs. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 29, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. Fred Meyer and QFC workers finalized a three-year contract that will increase wages and improve benefits to include health and dental care and retirement. Members of the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, Local 555, voted to ratify their contract with the Kroger-owned grocery stores on Monday. Local 555 was in negotiations with Kroger for much of this year and accused the company of unfair labor practices. They held a strike that included over 4,500 workers in late August that lasted 6 days. Kroger was refusing to budge, specifically on wage scales and pensions. The retail company was trying to merge with their rival, Albertsons, in a $24 billion deal during negotiations. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission, along with multiple states, including Oregon, sued to halt the merger to prevent a potential grocery monopoly. Local 555 was the only union to support the merger, but reversed its stance during the strike. A decision in the lawsuit is expected any day. Local 555 represents over 35,000 workers across Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Wyoming. Multnomah County will be adding more than 250 recovery and stabilization beds in the next 2 years, thanks to Metro's Supportive Housing Services tax revenue. The Board of County Commissioners invested in a series of behavioral health infrastructure plans a year ago. It allocated $14.4 million to stabilization and transitional housing beds to serve people in need, especially those on wait lists for residential treatment beds. Oregon's recovery network system is overburdened with high demand for services. The wait lists for residential treatment beds have been added to the bottleneck and kept people from receiving treatment. The Oregon Health Authority Behavioral Health Residential and Facility Study that came out in January of this year estimates that Oregon needs 3,700 more beds for behavioral health treatment of varying capacities. Though OHA is tracking its progress for inpatient treatment beds, it is not tracking the lack of recovery housing. Oregon currently has 4,800 beds serving people with stabilization, transitional, and recovery needs. The CEO of Fora Health, one of the treatment centers receiving funding, told KATU that recovery housing can help alleviate the wait lists. Devarshi Bajpai said, quote, "I've seen estimates that about half the people that need residential are getting into that level of care. I think many of those people could go into housing plus outpatient and receive much better care than they're receiving being on a wait list for residential bed." The county has organized the investments and allocations into six categories that range from emergency care to recovery-oriented housing. Half of the beds will be held for culturally specific needs. Some of the beds are already open, while others are in the works and expected to be open by fall of 2026. The City of Portland announced on Monday that its 10th shelter site will open by mid-November in St. John's. The North Portland Road Shelter includes 90 tiny home pods and space for up to 70 RVs. It is the first shelter site in the city to include both beds and space for people living in vehicles, and it is the second so-called safe parking shelter site after the city's Northeast Sunderland site, which is only for people living out of vehicles. The North Portland Road Shelter will be run by Urban Alchemy, a California-based nonprofit that the city contracted to run its first safe rest villages in 2022. Mayor Ted Wheeler said Monday that this new site increases the number of city-operated shelter beds to 868, all brought online since June 2022. That's in addition to many more beds operated by Multnomah County, most of which are in congregate dorm-style settings or converted motels. The North Portland Road site has faced criticism for being isolated in an area dominated by industry and nature preserves, with no pedestrian infrastructure and frequent noise from passing trucks. While acknowledging these issues, Urban Alchemy's Chief of Community and Government Relations, Kirkpatrick Tyler, pushed back in a statement to the Oregonian, noting that people living in vehicles or outdoors already deal with noise. Says Tyler, quote, "It's way better to have a noise issue while being surrounded by supportive services and people who care," end quote. The site is going to be filled by referral from outreach workers, and the city says people should call 311 if they wish to refer somebody, but cautions that it can take multiple weeks for the connection to be made. Multnomah County also opened a new shelter site over the weekend with less fanfare than the city's RV shelter. The Arbor Lodge shelter, located in a former Rite Aid at the corner of North Lombard and Denver, has reopened after a lengthy closure and will have 106 beds for people over 18 years old. These are further divided into 88 dorm-style beds, including beds for couples, as well as 18 tiny home pods reserved for women and non-binary individuals. Some of the beds are set aside for veterans. In total, combined with the North Portland Road site, around 300 new shelter beds will be online by mid-November. The Arbor Lodge shelter was previously opened during the early years of the COVID-19 pandemic. It is operated by the nonprofit Do Good Multnomah, which also runs several other congregate motel and tiny home shelters funded by the county. The shelter is to be filled by referral from outreach and 311, as well as by reservation. People can self-refer or be referred for reservation using a web form on Do Good's website at dogoodmultnomah.org/refer. However, as of today, only the form for veterans is open and wait lists for non-veterans are closed. Local police and FBI investigate arson fires in ballot boxes. Election officials nationally brace for possible threats. Speakers make controversial remarks at a Trump Madison Square Garden rally. And Hispanic evangelical voters draw attention in swing states. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In these times where we're seeing events like this morning, along with claims of rigged elections and illegal voters used as scare and avoidance tactics. Multnomah County is committed to the fundamental protection of our democracy.
Oregon County official Jessica Vega Peterson is promising to protect civil rights in spite of arson attacks on ballot boxes. The FBI says it's looking for the driver of a Volvo after three fires in Portland and Vancouver, Washington, that destroyed hundreds of ballots. Former President Donald Trump filled Madison Square Garden over the weekend. In a warm-up speech, comedian Tony Hinchcliffe made racially charged jokes.
There's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah, I think it's called Puerto Rico.
Puerto Ricans are a key voting bloc in Florida and Pennsylvania. Numerous Republican candidates and the Trump campaign itself are denouncing Hinchcliffe's comments, but Vice President Kamala Harris says they fit the pattern set by the former president.
Donald Trump spends full time trying to have Americans point their finger at each other. Fans the fuel of hate and division. They want a president of the United States not berating, not calling America a garbage can.
Roughly 10 million Hispanics consider themselves evangelical Protestants, and one pastor says they're seeing an awakening to their political power. Reverend Gabriel Salguero with the National Latino Evangelical Coalition says candidates' moral values are especially important to them, but there's a misunderstanding of how diverse they are.
Politicians don't know how to speak to us. They say, oh, well, they're evangelical, they must be Republican. Or, oh, they're Latino, they must be Democrat. Well, we're Latino evangelicals. And so, like me, I'm a registered independent.
Salguero, who is of Puerto Rican descent, says he wants a public apology for the racist comments at the weekend Trump rally. Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner is suing Elon Musk over his daily $1 million giveaways to registered voters who sign a pro-Trump petition. Krasner calls it indisputably unlawful. Machines are faster and more accurate at counting ballots than people, although some conservatives argue hand counting can protect against software-enabled fraud. About 150 small towns in Maine still count ballots by hand. Secretary of State Shenna Bello says communities can choose how they want to tally votes, and almost all use machines. But she says some say they value tradition and community involvement on election night.
They may prefer the old-fashioned hand count, recognizing that it's really important that they be as scrupulous as possible in ensuring the accuracy of that count.
The Washington Post is facing backlash, resignations, and mass subscriber cancellations following owner Jeff Bezos' decision to block an endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris. The State Department warns that desperately needed humanitarian assistance is not reaching northern Gaza. Meanwhile, the Israeli parliament just banned the UN aid agency from operating in Israeli-controlled territory. And President Joe Biden cast an early ballot in Delaware after waiting in line for half an hour. When asked if it was bittersweet to vote when not on the ballot, Biden replied that it was all sweet. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Ken Jones. He'll be speaking with Amanda Bullock about the Portland Book Festival. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather is partly cloudy with a low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be wet and cold with a high of 48 degrees. Today in history, the first ballpoint pen goes on sale in 1945. Debuting at Gimbel's Department Store in New York City for $12.50, over $200 in 2024 dollars, the Reynolds Rocket became the first commercially successful ballpoint pen. The quote of the day is from English author Edward Bulwer Lytton, who had an affinity for writing utensils. In his 1839 play Richelieu or the Conspiracy, he wrote, quote, "True this, beneath the rule of men entirely great, the pen is mightier than the sword," end quote. Alaska Native people are among those reacting to President Joe Biden's apology. A U.S. House resolution would have Columbus Day replaced by Indigenous Peoples Day. And a set of ceremonial Yebishe masks has been returned to the Navajo Nation. With more on those stories, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Native people are among those reacting to President Joe Biden's apology for the harm done to generations of Native children who were taken from their homes and forced to attend federal Indian boarding schools. Biden delivered the apology on the Gila River Indian community in Arizona last week. KMBA's Rhonda McBride has more from Alaska.
Among the boarding school survivors in the crowd was Jim LaBelle, an Alaska native and a member of the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition. He says before the speech, the president and his interior secretary, Deb Holland, embraced him and his wife.
It's almost indescribable how to express that feeling of acknowledgement. It was just a very spiritual moment, I think.
LaBelle says the president's apology was a powerful gesture, but there are those who never recovered from boarding school trauma and died young from addiction and suicide. He says he hopes their spirits heard the president's words. From 1878 to almost 100 years later, Alaska had more than 100 federally funded schools for Native children, a time in which they were punished for speaking their language, as well as physically and sexually abused.
It really is a big deal.
Benjamin Jasek watched the live stream of the president's apology from his office at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage, where he's the head researcher for boarding school history.
While an apology is welcomed and amazing, the work should never end right here, because this is just the beginning.
Jasek says without truth, there can be no healing, and without action, no meaningful apology. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The Alaska Federation of Natives praised President Biden's apology, but called for tangible steps towards healing and justice, such as a comprehensive investigation into the Indian boarding school era and revitalizing the Native language and culture they nearly destroyed. A U.S. House resolution would have Columbus Day replaced by Indigenous Peoples Day if a California Congresswoman's proposed legislation becomes law. Representative Norma Torres's bill would also make the second Monday of October a federal holiday. A member of the Congressional Native American Caucus, Torres says the recognition would celebrate the history, culture, and resilience of the continent's original inhabitants.
Native Americans welcomed Europeans sharing traditions, sharing food with them. And I think that we should recognize that this was all of their land, and we should respect them for that.
Torres is the sole member of Congress to introduce the legislation. 86 other U.S. House representatives are co-sponsors, all Democrats. A set of ceremonial Yabache masks has been returned to the Navajo Nation. Richard Begay, manager of the tribe's Heritage and Historic Preservation Department, says the cultural items are now back home. Begay says the donor did not have a complete history of the masks, but received them from friends. The 11 masks were returned from the San Francisco Bay Area. Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin says the items used in ceremonies are vital resources, and the return ensures survival of Navajo people and culture. Begay also says it's important for the return of the cultural items to Navajo people, who view them as integral to their heritage. According to the tribe, the last known return of Yabache masks were in 2014, when the Navajo Nation sent a delegation to France to retrieve 7 masks from a Paris auction house. Additionally, the department says a saddle blanket, traditional basket, and historic rugs were given back to the Navajo Nation from another donor. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A weekend football game in Tillamook was called off at halftime when players from one team refused to return to the field due to alleged racist statements from opposing players and a referee. A varsity game Friday night in Tillamook involved the Mustangs, representing Milwaukee High School, and the Tillamook High Cheesemakers. Third place in Division 4A was on the line. It was a tense match with multiple unsportsmanlike conduct penalties that caused the game to stop twice. During the first half, Tillamook players and a referee allegedly used racial epithets directed at Milwaukee players. Milwaukee, which was trailing 45-7, then refused to resume the game in the third quarter. According to Justin Brandon, the president of the booster club for the Milwaukee High School football team, slurs were directed by a Tillamook player towards at least one Milwaukee player with alleged use of the N-word. Brandon held conversations with coaches who were there and was told that one of the referees repeated the word. He added he was able to overhear the Milwaukee head coach ask the referee not to use the word, only to have the referee use it again. Brandon said, quote, "We didn't feel it was safe for our athletes, our players, and didn't feel supported in that community at all. It was a really tough situation. It was terrible." The Tillamook School District released a statement over the weekend noting the premature ending of the game due to allegations of unsportsmanlike conduct and the use of racial epithets, end quote. The statement said that the details of what transpired were unclear, but added Tillamook was committed to an investigation. The Milwaukee-Tillamook game is not the first athletic contest in Oregon this fall in which players felt unsafe or targeted based on race. Players on the David Douglas High School football team have dealt with racial epithets at multiple games this season. Brandon suggested teams responsible for such racist conduct should have to forfeit the game, and the players involved should be suspended. Lawmakers have attempted to intervene, passing House Bill 3409 in 2019. That bill requires schools to have policies in place for when derogatory acts occur. The Oregon Schools Activities Association, or OSAA, has also training materials intended to support a positive atmosphere at games. Officially, the game ended as a victory for Tillamook, giving them third place in the division. Officials at the two schools involved are limiting their responses. OSAA has also declined comment for now. Former editor of the San Quentin News is bringing his journalistic expertise to start a media center and newspaper at the women's facility near Chowchilla. Suzanne Potter shares the details.
Incarcerated journalists at a women's prison in the Central Valley have just published their first monthly newspaper, thanks to expertise from the former editor-in-chief at the San Quentin News. Jesse Vasquez was paroled in 2019 and now runs the nonprofit Pollen Initiative. This spring, he and his colleagues have launched a media center at the Central California Women's Facility near the small town of Chowchilla.
I wanted to expand the opportunities that we had at San Quentin of having a media center, having a newspaper, having a magazine, having a film program. I wanted to expand that to other prisons.
Vasquez and his colleague, Kate McQueen, began teaching a journalism class at the facility in March, and the students published the first edition of The Paper Trail in September. Rural prisons generally have less programming because they have fewer regular volunteers from the community. San Quentin, in the Bay Area, has 3,300 residents and 500 regular monthly volunteers. By comparison, the Central California Women's Facility houses 2,100 people and has about 100 monthly volunteers. Vasquez says the women at CCWF have important stories to tell.
Women haven't had a media center, they haven't had a prison newspaper, they haven't had an outlet, they haven't had a voice.
The San Quentin News and the Paper Trail are now published online and are available in print at every California prison, as well as digitally in 950 prisons and jails around the country. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
With just a week remaining until Election Day, advocates for open and fair elections in Montana and nationwide are highlighting steps that have been made in the right direction. But they acknowledge that challenges still remain. The coalition is calling on voters to cast their ballots, but to push for election transparency, too. With details on the story, it's Mark Moran.
With the election just a week away, advocates for fair elections in Montana met recently as part of a coalition to highlight efforts to protect voting rights at the state and federal levels. While the group says there has been progress, challenges remain. The event highlighted recent victories in the ongoing struggles to educate voters and ensure transparency at the ballot box. Montana Farmers Union President Walter Schweitzer says no matter a voter's political stripe, it's important for people to vote, but also to advocate for fair and open elections.
This is about showing up for the future of our state. Encourage your neighbors, family, and friends to stay engaged. Don't just vote. Keep pushing for transparency and fairness in our elections. Montana depends on all of us.
Schweitzer is part of a coalition that met recently to highlight progress made toward protecting voting rights. The group cited a Montana Supreme Court decision that struck down laws that would have made remote ballot collection more difficult, for example, which is especially important on Montana's 7 tribal reservations. Tribal advocacy groups have been working to help register Montana's indigenous population to vote and collect their ballots when transportation is a problem for people on tribal lands. Schweitzer says efforts aimed at limiting remote ballot collection damaged the state and nation's democratic process and is exactly the wrong direction for Montana to go.
In recent years, we've seen attempts to erode trust in our democratic institution. It's not just happening far away, it's happening here at home. Efforts to make it harder for Montanans to vote are a direct challenge to our values.
The election's a week from today, although mail-in balloting is already underway in Montana and other states. I'm Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are proposing huge tariffs on foreign, and especially Chinese, imports in the mistaken belief that tariffs are paid by the exporting industry. In fact, as Kalama Harris charges, they are a Trump tax paid by American consumers. As one observer notes, Trump's tariffs will prove very costly for all of us if he is elected. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. It's no secret that Donald Trump thinks the world of tariffs. Tariffs are the greatest thing ever invented, Trump said last month at a town hall event in Michigan. On another occasion, he said tariff is the most beautiful word in the English language. And he really has had a love affair with tariffs. After all, they mark his entry into national politics. Back in the mid-1980s, his one big gripe was the trade deficit with Japan. Then China became the target. As president, Trump kept raising tariffs with China in the belief China would bend a knee and surrender. It didn't, and Biden has been stuck in a tariff war with China ever since. Vice President Kamala Harris has referred to her opponent's tariff policy as a Trump tax. Several independent studies have found that the new tariffs, if implemented, would raise costs for the average middle-class family anywhere between $1,350 and $3,900 a year. The reason is simple. Tariffs are usually passed on to the consumer by the importing company, unless, of course, the company wants to eat the tariff cost. Yet Trump and Vance don't get it, either out of pure ignorance or for political gain, or both. They insist the exporting company pays. Referring to Harris's claim, Trump said, "She is a liar. She makes up crap. I am going to put tariffs on other countries coming into our country, and that has nothing to do with taxes to us. That's a tax on another country," he said. In September, he repeated the claim during an interview with Fox News, quote, "It's not a tax on the middle class, it's a tax on another country." Vance has chimed in that when Trump was president and raised tariffs on Chinese goods, quote, "prices went down for American citizens. They went up for the Chinese, but they went down for our people," unquote. Totally wrong. In fact, the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing opposed Trump's tariffs precisely because U.S. importers would have to pass along higher prices to consumers, making their goods less competitive. But Trump wasn't listening. As CNN reports, quote, "Trump has said that if elected, he would impose tariffs of up to 20% on every foreign import coming into the U.S., as well as another tariff upward of 60% on all Chinese imports. He also said he would impose a 100% tariff on countries that shift away from using the U.S. dollar. Hence, the Trump tax and the higher living cost for the average family. In fact, according to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, quote, "Americans have so far paid more than $242 billion to the U.S. Treasury for tariffs that Trump imposed on imported solar panels, steel and aluminum, and Chinese-made goods." And that's with tariffs Trump raised on only 14% of imports, not the 20 to 100% he and Project 2025 are now promising. The conservatives' response is to argue that even if prices rise due to higher tariffs, they create incentives to increase domestic production of normally imported goods, thus creating more jobs and higher income. Moreover, income taxes would be cut under Trump, since the tariffs would greatly increase government revenue. What actually happened when Trump was in charge? In a few cases, domestic production did increase, for example, in steel. But conservatives are conveniently ignoring several studies, like one from the Tax Foundation and another from the U.S.-China Business Council, which say that overall, the U.S. economy lost jobs due to Trump's tariffs and, very importantly, as happened with China, the retaliatory tariffs other countries put on U.S. goods and agricultural products. The longer the presidential campaign goes on, the more promises Trump will make about tariffs and tax cuts. He has proposed extending the 2017 tax cuts and eliminating taxes on tips, overtime pay, and Social Security benefits. That's all lost revenue that will have to be made up somehow. He has also said that the tariff revenue could pay for a child care initiative. And CNBC reported that he's floated the idea of replacing the federal income tax with tariff revenue. Millions of people may no longer have to pay an income tax, he said most recently. Still more head-spinning is a Trump prediction that China will never invade Taiwan because of the 150 to 200% tariffs he would impose. No responsible economist believes that such ideas make sense. Not only will tariff revenue fail by a long shot to cover a fall-off in tax revenue or pay for all his other social plans. According to an estimate by the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Trump's proposals would add $7.5 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. Harris's proposals, by contrast, would add an estimated $3.5 trillion. 23 Nobel Prize-winning economists just endorsed Kamala Harris's economic program. In short, among the many things Donald Trump is not, is someone familiar with basic economics. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 29, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Eliza Yurkov, Mel Gertov, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Mark Moran, Farah Siddiqui, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for an interview with Ken Jones. He'll be speaking with Amanda Bullock about the Portland Book Festival.